From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we're very thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, February 22nd is Cheese Fair Sunday for Orthodox Christians, who then begin the observance of Clean Sunday and the beginning of Great Lent. And sundown on the 25th marks the start of the Baha'i Intercalary Days, continuing through March 1st. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's radio show called State of Belief.
Haven't you taken one of the few bipartisan issues in this country, support for Israel, and turned it into a political football?
I have not.
This isn't a relationship founded on affinity between the Labor Party and the Democratic Party, or Likud and the Republican Party. This is the U.S.-Israeli relationship that extends beyond parties.
Vice President Joe Biden announcing on Friday that he will not be attending that event. Netanyahu's speech is expected to question the Obama administration's effort to negotiate a deal with Iran on its nuclear program.
In the weeks since House Speaker John Boehner secretly invited Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address Congress, the planned speech has generated endless controversy. Leading newspapers have covered the political backlash that's erupted both in the U.S. and in Israel, as well as the potential impact on Iran negotiations. Longtime Netanyahu supporters have been among those criticizing the move. For a look at what led up to the invitation and what's happened since that invitation was accepted, I'll be talking with Ron Campius, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency.
This order by the governor has declared open season on the gay, lesbian, and transgender workers in the state of Kansas.
Did they stop with one man, or one woman and one woman? Or did they go to multiple marriages? Or did they go to marriages between men and their daughters, or women and their sons?
It's one thing to hear of confusion in Alabama regarding the inevitable progress of marriage equality, or even of overt repeal of LGBT workers' protections in Kansas. Policies are one thing. Policies informed by a narrow understanding of what it means to be a Christian are one thing. Their impact on individual lives are something quite different. Recently, a first-person account of coming of age as a gay Christian in the Deep South was published that offers a better understanding of how much harder these externalities make a personal struggle that is already often incredibly difficult. On this week's show, you'll meet Brandon Wallace, author of the book called Straight Face. But first,
Al-Qaeda and ISIL and groups like it are desperate for legitimacy. They try to portray themselves as religious leaders, holy warriors in defense of Islam. And they propagate the notion that America, and the West generally, is at war with Islam. We must never accept the premise that they put forward, because it is a lie. Nor should we grant these terrorists the religious legitimacy that they seek. They are not religious leaders, they're terrorists.
This week, the White House convened a three-day summit under the banner of countering violent extremism. Attended by community and faith leaders, as well as activists from the U.S. and abroad, with time devoted to model programs and American citizen discussions, it was a well-intentioned and ambitious effort to address a very real problem. At the same time, many voices were raised expressing concern at the inordinate focus on Islam during the run-up to the summit. At the White House for the event was Glenn Caton, legal director of the organization Muslim Advocates, and Glenn joins us now on State of Belief Radio to talk about what happened. Glenn, welcome back.
Thank you, Reverend Gaddy. It's always a pleasure.
You know, Glenn, there's no question that ongoing efforts to counter violent extremism are incredibly important. At the same time, many of us had concerns about framing this summit in terms of Islam. Did you see that as a problem ahead of the summit?
Yes. I think the administration went out of its way to not overtly frame this as about Islam. The title of it is Countering Violent Extremism, and there's no mention in that title or in any of the panels about Islam or violence committed by Muslims. But the fact is that the content of the program and the content of much of what President Obama spoke about was the threat of violence by Muslims. The reason that causes so much concern is that extremist violent acts by Muslims in this country is actually only somewhere around 6% of extremist violence in this country. So by having the discussion focus so much on acts of violence by Muslims, by having government interface with Muslim community members so much on this topic, it really tells a false story of what the nature of the problem is.
Glenn, tell us a little bit about the conference itself. Who was there? What ground actually got covered?
There was a whole bunch of different panels and breakout groups. They're having a three-city pilot program now for countering violent extremism, although the efforts have been going on for many years. So they had separate panels from each of those three cities, from Los Angeles, Minneapolis, and Boston. And then they had speakers who spoke of innovative ways to try and address the problem of violent extremism. They had, for example, a woman who is the head of the Boston Public Schools talking about how they deal with just disaffected youth and counseling youth who might be vulnerable to kind of getting in trouble. They had religious leaders, chiefs of police, talking about everything from ISIL recruitment to lone wolf type attacks, and academics talking about studies they've conducted. So it was pretty comprehensive.
I'm curious about your reaction to President Obama's words at the summit. What'd you think of what the president said?
It was pretty powerful, and it was pretty long. And as I heard a couple of people say, you know, there was something in there for everyone. And he did speak in very bold and encouraging terms about terrorism has no religion. The overwhelming majority of Muslims in this country and the world are peace-loving, just like the overwhelming majority of people of all faiths. Although he said a lot of those things, and he said a lot of great things about how anti-Muslim hate is un-American, the truth is that the content of his speech was very heavily about how do we deal with Muslims who commit violence, and very, very little reference to the roughly 95% of other forms of violent extremism that exist in this country.
Was there a strategy or a call to action that you think will actually be valuable in the weeks and months ahead in confronting this problem?
I guess I'm sorry to say the answer to that is no, but it's not for lack of effort or goodwill. I mean, the fact is the first thing that Obama said, or one of the first things he said, was there's no way to predict who will become radicalized. So putting aside for a moment the problem with the term radicalization and the fact that it sets up this false theory that there's a path that you get on to become someone who's going to commit a violent act, the truth is, as he said, and as professionals in this area will say, you don't know who is going to become someone who commits an act of violent extremism. So we don't know that. The main academic there said that, you know, there is no empirical evidence on what types of countering violent extremism activities are effective. So we really don't know, as a matter of science and effectiveness, how to properly address acts of violent extremism. So I'm not encouraged that we have a really effective way, because addressing the problem is so elusive. I feel, unfortunately, like out of default, so much of the strategy is focused on American Muslims, and that's really a dangerous stigma that can lead to discrimination and hate crimes and lead to really just all forms of law enforcement surveillance and things that are just damaging to religious freedom and American Muslims generally.
Glenn, if you will, talk about the local level initiatives that were modeled. I think a lot of people have mixed feelings about the risk of ongoing police surveillance and profiling based on religion or ethnicity alone.
That is a very big problem among Muslim communities in the country and many religious minorities, frankly, who know the feeling of being singled out by law enforcement. So there's the subtext of we need to watch Muslims, and then there's the actual activity of surveillance of Muslims. The Intercept broke the story a couple of weeks ago about how some federal funding, I believe it was the Minneapolis Police Department, was intended to gather intelligence on the Muslim community there under the auspices of outreach. We've seen that in the past with the FBI doing outreach in Northern California, you know, saying, hey, we're your local FBI, and, you know, we just wanted to introduce ourselves, and then at the same time collecting intelligence that will then go into intelligence bases about innocent community members. So that is so dangerous because it just undermines the fundamental trust between law enforcement and the community. You know, how can people call law enforcement when they're worried that their name, their ethnicity, other members of their congregation might be recorded? I mean, it is really an insidious and dangerous problem.
As you look back on those very intense discussions, do you see areas of concern that you feel weren't addressed enough during those 3 days?
I guess I think the summit could have been more focused on the true breadth of the problem, which is to say that violent extremism takes many forms. And I'm not at all suggesting that law enforcement should treat environmentalists or animal rights activists or even white supremacists in the way they do American Muslims, which is to say either you're automatically suspect or, you know, you, Mr. Greenpeace activist, you know, we need to talk to you about other members of your environmental activism community about becoming radicalized. I absolutely don't want to see that. But at the same time, I feel like if the conversation is going to be honest and if it's going to be effective in terms of public policy, it really does need to address the full scope of the problem and not just focus almost exclusively on Muslims.
Glenn, what else did you take away from attending the summit this week?
You know, I took away that the administration, I really feel like they are appropriately being careful not to conflate overtly Islam with terrorism. And it's unfortunate that I take some degree of comfort in that because it should never happen. But the media and so many public figures do make that conflation, so that the fact that the administration is making a very strong effort to do that, I am encouraged. And then, you know, another thing, to be honest, is that even though myself and there were several other people there who really disagree with the way the administration is going about this, the fact that the administration invited us and wanted us to see what was going on, even though they knew that at the same time we would be criticizing them, again, is kind of encouraging in terms of the transparency and the sense of inclusion. I don't know if other administrations would have been that forthright.
Glenn Caton is legal director of Muslim Advocates, promoting freedom and justice for all. Glenn was at the White House this week, along with a diverse group of leaders and activists for the Summit on Countering Violent Extremism. Also present was Interfaith Alliance Executive Director Jack Moline. Glenn, as always, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, and keep up the good work at Muslim Advocates.
Thank you, Reverend. It's always a pleasure to be speaking with you.
There are times that it feels like American partisan politics is an insatiable beast capable of hijacking any issue or situation, no matter how grave or important, for its own selfish purposes. That's one lens through which one may view the ongoing controversy over Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's upcoming speech to the U.S. Congress. But in turn, that then makes it impossible not to consider the political implications of this particular visit. And joining me now to evaluate the situation is Ron Campius, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. Ron, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Ron, would you please start with just a quick summary of how we got to the situation that we're into today?
Well, the Obama administration is indicating that it might be actually close to an agreement with Iran in the negotiations between Iran and the major powers on stopping Iran from getting a nuclear weapons capacity. In fact, there's a deadline of March 24th for the outline of an agreement. Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is dead set against what the agreement looks like, although obviously he doesn't know exactly what it contains. And he is trying to make the case against the agreement as it looks now, and he wants to use any means he can to do that. And one thing he's done is he agreed to an invitation from John Boehner, the House Speaker, to speak to Congress. The thing is that unlike previous addresses to Congress by world leaders, the White House wasn't informed. Democrats, the other party, was not informed. Everything was kept secret until the morning of January 21st when it was made public, and the White House had an advance notification of about an hour or two before that. So folks are upset. They're upset because it's going to be just 2 weeks before Israel's elections, and it looks like, you know, there's the perception that it might be seen as U.S. interference in that, making Netanyahu look good. Mm-hmm. They're upset because it seems like a heavy-handed attempt by Netanyahu to engage in the American political scene, mm-hmm. because normally executives engage with one another across the international arenas. You don't usually go bypass a king or a president or a prime minister and just go straight to the parliament, which is what's happening here. So that's where we are.
Ron, the question I want to ask is who is using whom, or are both parties involved here using the other to try and get something that is important in each separate situation?
I think it's the latter. I think that they're both using each other in a sense. I think that Netanyahu, he really does see an urgency to trying and stopping the Iran agreement. And mm-hmm. The word that you keep on getting from people on his side is that diplomatic niceties are all well and good, but we really have to get this message across, and we're sorry if we're stepping on people's toes, but we really have to get this message across. Mm-hmm. On the Republican side, Boehner, the Republican leadership, they're kind of irked by the way that Obama is approaching his lame duck period. This is when presidents, especially presidents who just lost a midterm election, are supposed to start fading into irrelevance. And instead, on a whole bunch of arenas, not just on Iran, but on immigration and in other areas, Obama's being more assertive than he ever was before. So I think they see this as an end run around that, a way to show that they still have a voice equal to the president's on foreign policy. Although, as you know, some people would dispute, not just in terms of the personalities, but they would dispute that Congress should have an equal voice with mm-hmm. the executive branch when it comes to foreign policy.
Ron, is there anything new about this? Is it a new level of tug of war today? How far back does this kind of push and pull over Israel go on?
There have been crises in the past between Israeli and American governments. One thing that's interesting about this is that although it seems to have reached depths never before encountered in terms mm-hmm. of how public and how bitter it is, nobody on the American side is taking any measures to actually penalize Israel, whereas that has happened in the past. After Israel bombed the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981, Ronald Reagan actually suspended the delivery of combat aircraft to Israel. And George H.W. Bush wanted to stop loan guarantees to Israel unless it stopped settlement expansion in 1990-91. So there are those precedents. But Obama and Netanyahu just have fundamentally different worldviews mm-hmm. on a range of issues, on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, on the Iran issue, on how best to accommodate what's going on in the Middle East in terms of the Arab Spring, and they seem to be personalities that don't get along. They're both people who like to have the last word. Netanyahu, who had a better relationship, not a great relationship, but had a better relationship with Bill Clinton. There was an incident after a negotiating period with Netanyahu. Netanyahu left the room, and Clinton said, "Who was the superpower in here?" Because he was so sort of stunned by Netanyahu's self-confidence. And Clinton was probably a more accommodating character when it came to other world leaders. Obama's less so. So you have two very self-assured guys in the room, each convinced that the other guy is wrong. So I think that all contributes to it.
Hmm. Ron, in your writing about this for JTA, you describe Democrats' fears about possible 2016 ramifications of what's happening today. Talk about that a little more, please.
They're concerned, the pro-Israel contingent within the Democratic Party, because they want to keep Democrats pro-Israel. And there's been a flattening of support for Israel among Democrats, whereas there's been a rise among Republicans. And, you know, one way not to keep Democrats pro-Israel is to have an active clash between the Prime Minister of Israel and the President. And there are subtler indications as well. In terms of the speech itself, what's interesting is that the people who have announced that they're not going to go, a lot of them are from minorities. A lot of them are from the Congressional Black Caucus. And I'm sure that Boehner and Netanyahu didn't intend this. But when you have, let's say, the President of the United States giving a State of the Union speech and saying, "My position is X on Iran," and then the next day John Boehner invites the Israeli Prime Minister to say, no, here's the real position on Iran, from exactly the same forum, speaking to both houses of Congress, it looks like disrespect to a lot of black Americans. That's what I've been hearing. That's what I heard from Steve Cohen, a Jewish congressman who has a majority black district in Memphis. There's a sense that there's disrespect going on. And so there's a real concern, I think, that, you know, as minorities become more empowered within the Democratic Party, they're the part of the party that isn't necessarily that informed about Israel, and this is not the way to go about informing them about Israel. And on the other hand, what the squeeze is that there are right-wing pro-Israel forces like the Republican Jewish Coalition, the Emergency Committee for Israel, who say they will raise funds and campaign against Democrats who do not attend the speech, who are seen as not sufficiently pro-Israel.
Uh-huh.
There are people who are trying to very hard to figure a way out of this. Adam Schiff, who's the congressman from Southern California, who's Jewish and who's also the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, he said, "Okay, come and talk to us, but don't make it a joint session before Congress. Talk to us in private in terms of you know, what you can share in terms of classified information, because that would make more sense." And it does make more sense, because everything that Netanyahu has had to say publicly about Iran's nuclear program, he has said publicly. There's very little, I think, that he can say new, but perhaps if he really wanted to persuade lawmakers, he could meet with them in private, share information that he can't make public, and at the same time, save face all around. It won't be as if he's getting in your face with President Obama by making a public speech to Congress.
You know, it just seems to me that there is a pretty high cost involved in this kind of extreme partisanship for both the U.S. and Israel.
Yeah, there is. I mean, Israel has been a bipartisan issue or a nonpartisan issue for most of its existence in the United States. It's had the support of both parties to the degree that there was weak support in the past. And through the 1980s, there was a more isolationist section of the Republican Party that wasn't really enthusiastic about Israel. And that's actually been overcome. And now they're losing what had been for decades their traditional base. The Democratic Party, and there are people in the pro-Israel community, people who back Netanyahu, people who say that he's right about Iran, who say that this is also just exactly the wrong way to go about it, that you don't alienate the other party, you keep it bipartisan. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is true, too. You want the Americans shouldn't be involved in how Israelis pick a prime minister. It's always very sensitive for any sovereign nation when it seemed as if there are outside forces who are being heavy-handed. The funny thing is that this happened in 1996 when Bill Clinton really didn't want Netanyahu to win the election, and he really did Bigfoot in the sense that he openly and very warmly embraced Shimon Peres. He had him in Washington a month before the election to sign an agreement. And the person who said then that it was inappropriate and who was correct it was inappropriate was none other than Benjamin Netanyahu.
That is so much a characteristic of politics.
Yeah.
Well, we know what's happening in the United States in relation to all of this. What's happening in Israel? Is there any kind of backlash or change that comes as a result of all of this?
You know, not in terms of polling yet. I mean, I think Netanyahu is still worried. He's still neck and neck with the opposition in terms of the election. Not in terms of polling. What I mean by that is in terms of how people will vote. In terms of how people perceive it, yes, people think that he really made a mistake in accepting the invitation to speak, but that doesn't necessarily change their mind about how they're going to vote on March the 17th.
I see. Ron, I know there are plenty of people who disagree, but I do have concerns about the religious component in all of this. Later this year, Pope Francis is supposed to address Congress. I can't help but ask myself, isn't there a better way to ensure U.S. lawmakers don't get drawn in to kind of playing favorites among the world's religions, even while recognizing that both of these leaders are heads of state? How should I look at that?
I think that's a concern. I don't think it's necessarily a concern in terms of the specific speeches to Congress. In a sense, it's almost like affirmative action. You know, mm-hmm. You don't have to beat down the religion that's more comfortable or has a better place in society. You have to lift up the other one. And mm-hmm. So I think, for instance, what's interesting is that in terms of the conference on extremism that's going on now, there are appeals to Obama. There have been appeals from Muslims to endeavor not to make Islam, the whole religion, a villain in terms mm-hmm. of what's been happening recently with the attacks in Paris, but to focus it on extremism and to emphasize that Islam is not the villain. And what's interesting, there was a letter to Obama making that point from a bunch of liberal groups, and three of those groups were Jewish, and not marginal little Jewish groups. One group was the National Council of Jewish Women, which is a fairly established and widespread organization.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the way to do it, to be mindful, to embrace the Pope, to embrace Netanyahu, to make sure that they understand that their religions have a safe place in America, that the people, that Muslim, that Christian Americans, Catholic Americans, and, you know, not so long ago there was discrimination against Catholic Americans and Jewish Americans, have a place at the table, but to make it clear that Muslims also have a mm-hmm. have a place at the table. The difficulty there is there's nobody who represents Catholics the same way that that Francis does. There's nobody who represents Jews the same way that Netanyahu does. There isn't really a central Muslim figure mm-hmm. who can fulfill that role.
Ron, I know your job is to analyze and report what is rather than to make predictions, but do you anticipate any major shift in where we're going? Is there going to be any changing of minds about whether or not Netanyahu should be here? Or are we on course for this visit and speech and need to simply be getting ready to analyze what happens after it's over?
I think that, you know, once the speech is out of the way and once the bad feelings from the speech are out of the way,
mm-hmm.
hopefully we'll get back to a discussion of whether the Iran agreement is solid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and a lot of people have pleaded, I mean, Democrats in Congress have pleaded with Netanyahu and with Boehner to postpone consideration until after not just the Israeli elections, but at least until after the March 24th deadline for the outline of an agreement. That's where the real discussion should be, and I hopefully that's where it will return, to analyzing whether this agreement really will guarantee that Iran doesn't go back to advancing nuclear weapons research.
But you don't see, if I'm hearing you correctly, you don't see any possibility that at the last moment Netanyahu is going to say, well, I'm going to step back till after the elections or something like that.
You know, that's happened in the past. That anything can happen in the Israeli firmament. Anything could happen, for sure. I mean, when I was 18, I remember I attended my first political lecture. I was living in Israel, and the issue was, women's service in the army, and the ultra-Orthodox in Israel always opposed women serving in the army, and they managed to pass this measure, whereas previously, to get an exemption from the army, you had to pass a religion test. In other words, you had to show that you had the knowledge to show that you were religious, and they managed, the ultra-Orthodox banished the religion test, and they had this guy in a room, veteran political correspondent, saying, that's it for women in the army, because everybody is going to pretend that they're religious. And I said, well, you know, won't they be visible on the on Saturdays, on Shabbat, wearing swimsuits on the beach? And the guy said, you know, Ezra Weitzman, who is a defense minister, he's not going to send soldiers with cameras to the beach on Saturday. 6 months later, there was a headline in the papers, Ezra Weitzman sends soldiers to the beach with cameras on Saturday.
I tell you, perspective is a wonderful thing, and you've got it, and that's why we wanted to talk with you today. Ron Campius is Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. He's written insightfully about the ongoing tensions created by House Speaker John Boehner's secret invitation for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address the U.S. Congress on March 3rd. This is a difficult and complicated subject. There are consequences at stake that are rather serious. And Ron, I really appreciate your help in helping us better understand all of what's in play here. As always, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Brandon Wallace grew up in Arkansas knowing two things. He was called to the ministry, and he was gay. From serving as a youth minister in the Southern Baptist Convention to working as a teacher today in Tennessee, Brandon has found a passion for sharing his own journey of reconciling his sexuality and his faith in the hope of helping others in similar circumstances. So I'm very pleased to welcome Brandon Wallace to State of Belief Radio. Brandon, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dr. Getty.
Start, if you will, with just a brief summary of the world in which you grew up.
Well, I grew up in the heart of the Deep South in Arkansas. My family started going to church when I was about five, at a little small General Baptist church, about 30 or so people. And then as I grew up and I went off to college, I moved to a kind of a bigger city. It's still not huge, but it's a big city for me because I come from a town of about, you know, 700 people. Mm-hmm. And then while I was there, I began working in the ministry for a Southern Baptist church.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can remember, I've always been the little church boy, though. You know, you just kind of grew up in evangelicalism and just kind of stuck with it.
Did you know there was anything else?
Well, I knew there were other ones, but, you know, they were all wrong.
Right, right, exactly. And what were the messages that you heard about being gay and being Christian, and how did they strike you?
Well, I mean, all I've ever heard growing up was that they were completely mutually exclusive. There was no way you could be one or the other. I still remember one of the first sermons I heard about it. I still hadn't quite had a word for my sexuality, but I was getting there. And I remember learning what the word gay was actually in a sermon about Sodom and Gomorrah. And I still remember the passion of the sermon of just how, you know, these men who are attracted to men are basically the downfall of our society and our religion and everything we hold dear. And I remember just sitting in the pew going, oh boy, this is not good news for me. You would have to choose one or the other. And that's the mindset that I really fell into. That was the whole point of straight faith. I knew that these attractions were there and they weren't going away. And so I kind of thought, well, if I mask them enough, or if I play this role well enough, then maybe, just maybe, some of that love of God will actually roll over onto me too, and I can experience it. But, you know, once you're told over and over again that who you are at your core, it's not possible to follow Christ and be that, you know, that puts a toll on your mind after a while. You know, just thank God that he finally got me to a place where I saw that, you know, there wasn't much truth into that they aren't mutually exclusive. They can actually coexist.
Brandon, what age did you begin to struggle with these issues, and what happened after that? What were the key moments, the turning points, as you look back?
For me, it goes all the way back to, I'd say, before I was even 10 years old. I mean, I've known I was attracted to same sex since I was a little bitty guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we started going to church when I was about 5 or 6. So it all started way back then, and trying to figure it out. I remember once I figured out how to word for my sexuality, that's where it all started. I guess that's the key point. And I just started digging, and it started with trying to pray the gay away to begin with. I spent years doing that.
Hmm.
You know, just God, just make this go away, change this. And then once I hit probably my late teen years, I kind of resolved that, okay, it's no longer a phase. This is something I'm going to have to deal with somehow, some way, and make it work with my faith. And that's where straight faith came in. I decided to just kind of create this alter ego. And that was my way of dealing with God. It was like, okay, if I can hide this from God, hide this from myself, hide this from other people enough, maybe it won't be true. And then I would say probably the early part of my college career is when I was a philosophy major in college. And so I started reading other writings from people kind of outside of my little subgroup, which was, you know, deep conservative Christianity. And I started to understand that people read scripture differently and that there was actually some backing behind it, these scholars. And so I just started digging and spent years just in the dorm room, in my bedroom, just whenever I could get a chance to get away and dig into the scriptures myself. And, you know, I'd say probably 3 or 4 years of doing that hardcore. And I finally got to a point where theologically I was okay with the fact that I was gay and that I was a Christian, but I still didn't quite want to come out. I mean, it was more of a pride issue. Even though I was okay with it theologically, I was still deeply in the culture, and I was like, well, you know, if I come out, that's definitely going to rip that option away. Mm-hmm. Plus, I was still doing ministry, and so it was, for me, it was the greater good. It was just like, okay, I could just stay celibate, stay in the closet, nobody will ever know, and still just do my ministry. Mm-hmm. But then there was a kid. It was September of 2011. This 15-year-old kid killed himself. It was all over the news, and he had done it simply because he was gay and deeply in the conservative family. And, you know, he felt like he had no other option. And I had been there before when I was about his age. You know, I knew it brought all that back for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when God and I really had it out. I was just weeping over this kid, and I felt like God was just saying, okay, this is it. I want you to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, and that's stupid. Why would I want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we found it out, and finally God was just like, you know what? If you don't come out, you're part of the problem, and this kid's blood's on your hands as much as anyone else, because you know that this group, your group, is being silenced and being forced into, you know, suicides and living a double life, and it's wrong. And so that was probably my big turning point. I'd like to say that I gave right into God right then, but I didn't. We still fought it out for a few months. But as you can see, eventually he won it over.
Uh-huh. So what was going on when you decided, I've got to write about this, I've got to share my story, and what brought you to the title Straight Face?
I didn't mean to write a book. This just kind of happened. When I came out, it was not pretty. It was a... I actually got outed. I didn't come out. I got outed at the church. And I was working for a pretty large-sized church, and it got ugly really quickly. It was bad enough I had to change my number, had to, you know, delete a lot of people on social media. I got so many messages. It was just so bombarding for a while. I couldn't even really deal with it. I mean, I did have the supporters, too. But, man, just message after message of just, you know, wish you had never been a part of this, wish we never knew you. Go away, hope you disappear. Just, I mean, it gets worse and worse.
Hmm.
You know, I even got a few threats and stuff. I had already moved to Memphis and kind of gotten away from everybody, so I've felt safer and safe enough to finally give some context. So my original thought was, you know, I'm going to sit down, write a little, you know, 4 or 5 paragraphs just to kind of explain myself, just to give them some sort of context.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Starbucks that morning, I sat down and started writing, and it just poured out of me. End of the first day, I had, you know, 5,000-6,000 words, and I had just started. And so I went back the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and before I knew it, like a week later, I had like 55,000 words, and it was my therapy, basically.
Yeah.
It just really came right out. You know, it had been bottled up for so long. Once I opened up those floodgates, you know, the dam broke loose.
Mm-hmm.
It was just all out there. For me, I felt better. I didn't even do anything with it. I didn't post it like I intended to. I was just like, you know what? I feel better. I've gotten this out. I'm just going to kind of tuck this away and kind of move on. But a friend of mine, she knew that I was writing it, and she wanted to read it, so she did, and she got my permission, and she passed along to someone else, until eventually it just landed in the hands of the publisher, and they called me up and was like, hey, let's publish this. So I'm like, all right. So, you know, the book originally was just, like I said, my therapy, my way of just dealing with it and processing a bunch of stuff, but God's been able to use it to, you know, help other people in the same situation. One thing I'm seeing a lot of, it's really been more helpful, not for the people that were gay in Christianity, but really the people around them, their family members, their friends, the people that are trying to understand what's going on, because what I do in Straight Face is I set it up as a narrative, because this is really how I lived my life for so long, of these three characters. And you've got God, you've got me, and then you got Straight Face. And Straight Face is this alter ego that kind of runs everything, and it's this mask that goes up in front of everyone else and in front of God. And so the book really just kind of details the psychological side of what it's like to be in the closet, deeply inside the religious environment.
Brandon, what do you know now that you wish you had known a long time ago?
The basic thing that I wish I would have known 10, 15 years ago is that there's absolutely nothing that can ever separate me or anyone else from the love that God has for us. You know, I spent so many years trying to force God to love me until finally I had the realization that, and it was God telling me that he's always loved me, always going to, and nothing can ever change that. You know, my big moment was when, right at the very end of God not fighting it out, was God coming to me and saying, look, Brandon, I love all of my creation. You know that. But Straight Face is your creation, not mine. I don't love Straight Face. I love the guy behind the mask. And that's something that I wish I could tell 15-year-old me.
Brandon Wallace is an author and an educator sharing his story of growing up in the South and reconciling his Christian faith with his homosexuality. The book is titled Straight Face. Brandon, thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Before we go, even as prominent community leaders and advocates struggled with the deadly threat of violent extremism at this week's White House summit, it was disheartening to read about a so-called alternative summit organized earlier in the month by anti-Muslim activist Frank Gaffney. Luminaries from the right flocked to the event. Bobby Jindal, Ted Cruz, Steve King, as well as Family Research Council's Jerry Boykin, and others. The naked political nature of this gathering was exposed when President Obama was bluntly accused with, quote, siding with the enemy of freedom in the Middle East. As effective as this kind of divisive rhetoric may be in riling up the base, it is so unspeakably irresponsible to do so at a time when innocents, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, are losing their lives in horrific ways at the hands of extremists who have hijacked the name of Islam and are doing their absolute best to incite a global religious war. Events like Gaffney's play right into the hands of our real enemies. And they feed a narrative that only adds insult to injury for faithful Muslims in America and beyond who face heartbreak and hatred every day as their sincerely held religious beliefs are misrepresented in sadistic and inhuman ways. But I want to end today's show on a hopeful note. Even as supposedly responsible journalists endlessly badger White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest over why the president allegedly refuses to label violent extremism as Islamic, even as anti-Muslim sentiment is on the rise around the world, even as fundamentalists of all stripes wish nothing less than total extermination of fundamentalists of other stripes, there are millions and millions and millions of us who refuse to give in to their fear-mongering and the hate baiting. This week, in Oslo, Norway, A 17-year-old Muslim named Hajrat Arshad responded to growing anti-Semitic harassment in that country by calling for fellow Muslims to form a friendship ring around the local synagogue for Shabbat services. A slightly skeptical member of the Jewish community was quoted as saying, "It would be meaningful if 30 Muslims gathered for this physical expression of solidarity and protection." Well, as of earlier this week, 1,200 people had signed up. Better still, other communities have begun working on replicating this expression of love and support as well. Friends, cynics will try to dismiss this as an empty act of symbolism, maybe even of naivete. But listen, nothing could be further from the truth. Standing together, standing up for each other, is all that we can really do. But the good news is, it's all we really need to do. The merchants of hate are powerless against those of us who refuse to hate. The doctrine of division is powerless against those of us who stand together. And the philosophy of fear is powerless against those of us who step outside our comfort zone and simply say, enough. And there is no committee or conference, no summit or symposium that will ever be as powerful as that simple act if enough of us do it together. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. I want to thank you if you've made a donation to us this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Your financial support will be greatly appreciated. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And we hope that you will share the stories that you find compelling on this show with your friends. We're also at twitter.com/stateofbelief. Look, this isn't a time that we can take anything for granted. We need as many people in this conversation as we can possibly get. If you find value in what you hear on State of Belief Radio, please spread the word about State of Belief Radio. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.